So just for the purpose of delivering a message this late in the afternoon and before the cookies, I'm going to be speaking a little bit in extremes, and I don't mean to be so strident, but it's just to deliver the clearest message I can, because it's there are obviously a lot of nuances to what I'm going to talk about, but the emphasis in, do you have a pointer or?
There's a wooden pointer to the left
there. Ah. Does it work?
It does, perfect.
No, I don't like that.
You don't?
No. Just if that, that has laser?
Yes. Like the button in the front.
Yeah. Do you see it?
See what?
The red, not enough battery. Any case, the key to emphasize in the message that I want to give you about the cocktail party and all of that is the first two words, temporal coherence. Ah, thank you. So the claim that I will try to explain and defend is that segregation, whether it's in fact auditory or visual or anything, is completely determined by the temporal structure of the stimulus. And all the other stuff is really detail that helps you resolve the temporal stuff. So it makes the problem actually quite simple. So let me explain. This picture you've seen many times before. You have an orchestra playing music with many sections, with different instruments and so on, which is really no different than having a mixture of two speakers. When I ask you to listen to this orchestra, you can listen to one section of it that happens to be playing a different melody than the rest, for example. You can listen to also to the whole orchestra when it's playing all in unison as one source. These different modes of listening are perfectly valid and illustrates the difficulty of defining what we mean by segregating sound. So I will make this more concrete. But the basic cartoon you want to think about is something like this, that when you listen to a particular source in the orchestra, whether it's the violins or the wind instruments and so on, the signals coming from there basically become subject to attentive processes. Part of the segregation process involves that, and that signal amplifies compared to the rest, and it comes into your foreground, and the rest becomes background. That's the cartoon. I want to make sure that, because we had a lot of talks about this last week, that the cocktail party is absolutely exists also in vision. It's just we don't think of it as much. This is a scene, very complicated scene, has a lot of objects in it. It's a stationary picture. Why on earth would you, it's obviously for everybody that this is one object, this man, this umbrella, this cart, and so on. But there's absolutely no logic to explain why on earth you do that. Why should this man be one object when he's got a white thing on top of his, there's a black beard, there's a blue, there's different colors, edges in all different directions, no different than basically all the other edges that supposedly distinguish him or segregates him from the rest of the scene. So all this mess of features, edges and colors and all of that, yeah, of course, they distinguish different parts of different things, but there's no logic to it to say that this is one source based on that. That is very much a visual cocktail party problem. That's exactly what happens in the auditory. You have a lot of different sounds coming from different places. Why on earth would one harmonic pitch harmonic from a complex sound somehow comes from a source that is different from the rest of the other pitches that are exactly at the same frequency or completely different frequency but playing in unison, yet we hear them as one complex source. So, penguins, the same thing. Penguins, two things they do. First, they have to look at this visual scene and know what is a penguin and what is a rock and what is ice and what is this and what is that. The edges and blacks and whites and everywhere. Why should this be one penguin when there's half of it is black, half of it is white? There's a huge edge, just like the edge he has on his back against the snow. What makes it one object that is different from the scene? And also, penguins walk into the scene with no physical cues. The reason I put the penguins is because they're the champions of the cocktail party problem. They can walk into a scene and a mother can detect its chick in a massive scene of hundreds of penguins all yelling and go, you know, how to home in onto this chick based on, I guess, memory and segregating that source from the rest of the...
On sound.
Yeah. Okay. So this picture is just to illustrate two important things that I'll be discussing. And that is, when you look at a spectrogram of a complex sound, like one coming from a vocalist and drums and a guitar and so on, you see that these different sounds, sources, basically produce a lot of structure in there. And these we can trivially segregate and listen to only one line or another. A conductor can trivially do this with much more complicated scene. They're doing two things when they're doing that. One is they're assigning different labels to different lines in here. And that's what we call the... I'm just going to call them simultaneous processes. They're rapid assignment of different harmonics, for example, as Tobias was describing, or different lack of harmonics here. These are obviously the beats of the drum and so on. But the other really key important thing that we do all the time when we segregate is that we need time. We need a period of time of the order of about half a second to a second to create essentially what you might call a track. Sequentially tracking the sound source. These two work together in order to segregate sound out of the scene. And you'll see why that is. Okay. To tell you that you need adaptive processes to do this, and I mentioned this yesterday in the sense that when you walk into a room and you begin to segregate different sources, it takes very little time, half a second to a second, to begin to lock on to a particular source of interest to you. And in doing so, you've adapted your brain and you've changed what your brain is listening to, so to speak. And that takes, that presumably what happens is initially, for example, the music and a baby crying, they create a uniform or at least distributed pattern of activity that once you differentiate them and pay attention to the baby or to the music, you can picture that as being segregated patterns of activity. So therefore, in going from here to here, the same exact sound now produces two different types of responses, which means that very rapid adaptive processes happened. And it's really all, the whole cocktail party problem solution is in these rapid adaptive processes that change the properties of the way the neurons respond in order to segregate these sources. So initially we have a rich representation of many different features. So the three key components, I very quickly, yesterday I talked about all this In order for you to segregate sounds, you really need a lot of features to play with. And just like in the visual scene, it helps to segregate and create object percepts of different objects. If you have color, ability to see color, ability to see edges, you have all kinds of other cues. Without these cues, it's very hard. In the auditory, we have all these different attributes for all sounds. The pitch, different frequency components, the timbre, the loudness, the location in space. All of them play the same role, which is provide basic features that we can put together to create the percept of sources, different sources. And the rapid adaptive, I explained. And finally, I will explain the temporal coherence when we get to it. Okay. I'm going to now go fast because we talked about this yesterday. The cortical representation of sound. Everything about the auditory system in the early stages is extracting those features, as I explained yesterday. Those features are important in the process of segregation, but they are not at all about segregation. So pitch helps you to segregate, but it's not at all the reason we segregate. And I will explain by how that happens. And the same with location. Features are, the hypothesis and that drives our work is that the features are put together into quote-unquote objects or sources. I use the word source in the same way as I use object and vision, so to speak. Is in the auditory cortex and beyond, primary auditory cortex and beyond. As you go towards higher and higher level processes, these different features are put together to create the percepts of objects. Earlier than that, you have basically disconnected features. Another important thing to keep in mind is that by the time you get to the cortex, we are not talking about very fast, rapid temporal things and all that. They really are irrelevant. At the level of the cortex, you're talking about the slow things of the order of the sweet spot of about 5 hertz. That's what determines segregation, whether it's visual, auditory, and so on. So that's because that's where they're explicitly represented and can be used in order to separate objects or bind features and so on. And this is the picture I explained yesterday. So now, if we are talking at this level here, all the features have been extracted, what binds them together to create the percept of a source and segregate it from another source? So I'm sure you heard about this experiment, so I will just very quickly repeat. These experiments were done by Eddie Chang and Nima Mazgarani at UCSF, where they recorded in humans paying attention to different speakers exactly the way the experiment Tobias mentioned, to male or the female. And they recorded it while the subjects were listening to these mixtures, and on the fly they tell them, pay attention to the male or to the female using a keyword. The upshot of it all is that when you do that, when you're listening to a mixture, you remember I explained yesterday that you can listen to, you can record all these responses and reconstruct back the spectrogram that generated them. If you do it for a single female, the sentence looks like this in a spectrogram of the sentence looks like that. If you do it for the male, the spectrogram looks like that, but this is single speaker. If you now in the mixture add the two and ask them to pay attention to the female, you basically reconstruct back the spectrogram of the female. If you ask them to pay attention to the male, you reconstruct the male. This happens within 100 milliseconds. Within 100 milliseconds, the patterns of activation now begin to reflect the attended speaker. You've adapted your neurons that rapidly. And Jonathan Simon demonstrated that with MEG, and other people. We've done that also with EEG, with Ed Lalor and others. And now it's standard procedure, as you know, in many different techniques, you can now demonstrate that this thing happens real rapidly, and you can get the evidence non-invasively or invasively, as you wish. And this is actually one project that Alain is leading at Ecole Normale, where we use that knowledge from the EEG to direct microphones to one speaker or another according to your intended target. So if you want to pay attention to the male, your hearing aid would home in onto the male. And how does the hearing aid know? It knows because I'm trying to listen to the male and I amplify the signal of the male, and we can decode that. And then, okay, so in a ferret, it's tough to,
What?
You mean, well, you can do all the different steps. Putting it all together, I think, has been demonstrated. Maybe you guys are going to talk about this?
No, I won't talk about it. But it's not something you can buy off the shop. But demonstrated it successful. It's something.
Well, there's some unknowns. For example, a person with a hearing aid, how good are they at actually segregating? They have difficulty and all that. But in principle, if you're able to segregate, we can easily sort of track from single trials even one person or another. But can you do it in somebody with a hearing aid and all of that? And can you do it rapidly, real time, and all of the little details of the process? Yeah. So in a ferret, we've trained ferrets also to do this kind of task. We're paying attention to speech of one speaker or another. And it's a bit tricky because the way we do it with ferrets is we train them on a particular word. I think I explained this a little bit yesterday. And the ferrets listen to the female voice waiting for the word to come, and then they would signal that they heard it. And we add a male in the background. And then they, so the male is in blue and the female is in red, and they can then track the female and respond only to the female when she says the target. They ignore the male when he says the target. So we have collected a lot of data now, but we haven't analyzed it yet. But let me just skip that. I want to get to the whole point about temporal coherence and how do you benefit from all of this. One thing I didn't talk about today, but I did talk about it yesterday for those of you who weren't here, is that as you pay attention, as you get engaged in the task of separating and all that stuff, you get these really rapid adaptive changes that happen, as I said, within a few hundred milliseconds. So we were looking for evidence of that when the animals are paying attention to one speaker or another, or if they're, as I'll explain, if they're listening in a particular way, how quickly all of these events happen, and can they serve the hypothesis? So let me explain to you the hypothesis. So a lot of you have heard this before. Anybody has not heard the two-tone streams and all of that? Has not? Wow, okay. Everybody knows this?
I don't, but you don't need to do this for me. Please do it.
All right, very quickly. If you listen to this sequence of tones, it sounds like a galloping rhythm. If I play it for an hour, it continues to sound like a galloping rhythm. And the reason is you're hearing the two tones in sequence all the time. So this is what it sounds like. Right? Nothing is going to change. The two tones, the hypothesis goes, is that the two tones are too close. So they are perceived as one stream, so you hear it as a sequence, and therefore it sounds like a galloping rhythm and it's going to continue to do so. If you take them apart a little bit, what happens is within half a second or a second, you lose that galloping percept and the sounds split into two streams, the upper one and the lower one. And in fact, it's hard for you to hear the galloping after that. So see if this is the case. You just can't even hear it galloping anymore. You hear teet, 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 or
teet, teet.
Just at the first, yeah. And after that, they split, takes about a second or so, and then it splits, yeah. So that's all of that. So the hypothesis has always been that it's because the tones are separated far apart, so they belong to different streams, and therefore that's the way segregation happens. In fact, it turns out that it's not the reason. The reason is because those tones were alternating. When you have alternating channels with decorrelated activity or anti-correlated, they split apart perceptually. And if you, on the other hand, have the tones be synchronous, and you can have the channels as far apart as two octaves, and they still sound like a single source. And this is the most subtle part of the whole talk. So let me just play you this and explain one more time. So those tones are very far apart. Everybody here can hear probably two tones, a high tone and a low tone. That's not the point. The point is they are perceived as a single source coming, that is coming from a single source. And the question is, why? How do I believe you? Why would I believe you? I can hear them as separate. For example, let me just, for the purpose of illustration, get to the task that I haven't seen the Alan's task, but play you two vowels, A and E. I play them simultaneously, exactly the same length, start at the same time, end at the same time, and I repeat it. You can hear two vowels. However, they're not segregated. They're just a complex sound composed of two vowels by this logic. Okay? And the reason is because all the channels that are driven by these two vowels are driven exactly the same timing. They're completely correlated. And therefore, they're perceived as single source. How do I know that? Let me just finish this one line. How do I test this? The whole purpose of segregation is that you can attend to one source and avoid interference from other sources. So you can put subjects and ask them, pay attention to this vowel and tell me if a deviant happened in this vowel and ignore all other deviants from the other vowels. People are terrible at it, no matter how far the tones are, no matter how far the vowels are, when they're synchronous. As soon as they are desynchronized, it's trivial. People just can pay attention to one and ignore all the rest. And this has been done now in many different stimuli, different forms, and so on. That is the objective way to measure whether you're listening to a single source or a complex source, like an orchestra. If the orchestra is all playing in unison, that's a single source. And if one section is playing different melodies or different speeds or different what have you, then it's trivial for you to segregate that one source. The same thing with a choir, with the bass and the soprano. If they're all singing in unison, it's a single source. In fact, let me just tell you a thought experiment. If I ask the bass to make a mistake, and I tell you, please tell me when the choir makes a mistake. Specifically, I want you to tell me when the soprano makes the mistake. And I tell the bass to every now and then make a mistake. People will be very bad at it. They will not be able to tell you that it was the soprano who made the mistake, despite the fact that they can hear trivially there was a mistake happen. It's just that they don't know which part of the source because it's one source. Does that make sense? Did I make myself clear? Okay. Sorry.
You know, these are two extremes. Like in one case, you have no overlap. In other one, you have a perfect overlap. There must be something in between.
Yeah, it takes about 30 milliseconds to segregate.
So if you have 30 milliseconds, no overlap, or
30 milliseconds between the onsets, generally, starts sounding segregated. Sorry.
Does the ability of human subjects to discriminate change whether you, depending whether you have like a tritone frequency separation or a fourth or a fifth?
So people are very good at telling the different pitches of the different simultaneous chords. You can name all the parts of the chords and all that stuff. That's not the same as saying that they are single source or multiple sources. That depends on the history of these tones that were notes that were played. If they were always played together as an octave, I'm sorry, as a chord, then they are a single object, single source. And therefore, everything I said applies.
Whether they're harmonically related or not.
Doesn't matter at all if they're harmonics. Harmonics are no different than inharmonics. Harmonics simply come together. The special thing about harmonics is they fuse and give you the percept of pitch. If they were inharmonics, it sounds like a collection of tones, but they still behave the same way with respect to being a source or a non-source.
So obviously the conductor can determine that the soprano made a mistake.
Not if they're singing in you. Well, look.
That's the role of the conductor.
A really good conductor.
Lost the separate parts that are made mistake.
Right. So an expert, okay. First of all, it's unlikely that the soprano and the bass for a long period of time, they're going to be singing exactly the same thing. So in cases where they're not, it's trivial for the conductor to tell what happened. Who made the mistake?
So training, I guess my question.
That is not to do with...
Can you improve the separation
and the balance? No, this is where you weren't here when I started the whole talk saying, I'm going to talk in black and white, but there are nuances. All of this basically, with respect to the conductor, when you look at a picture, a face, I was saying, you weren't here, that this face has edges and all these different parts and all that stuff. And there, but nevertheless, it's viewed as a single object. I'll explain how that relates to what I'm just talking about with temporal coherence. But the point is that within an object, you can still pay attention to different parts of an object. And you can still say the eyes are big, or the nose is small, or this, or that. You can answer questions like that. So that's where the subtleties begin to, attention to within an object versus attention to the whole source and so on. Yeah. So yes, with training, a conductor can do anything. Yeah. Okay. Why is speech very similar to the two tones? When you have two speakers, a male and a female, speaking different texts, they're not saying the same words and all that. This would be the waveform. And what you see is that there's the pink, green, here there's overlap, then there's green, pink, just like alternating, right? And the voices of the male and the female, when they produce energy by opening their mouth, they produce a lot of features simultaneously. So if I measure the pitch of the female, this is a pitchogram. And let's say this is 200 hertz, 400 hertz. Whenever the female is strong, when she opens her mouth and she's uttering a vowel, for example, her pitch signal is very strong. When the male is uttering a strong signal, his pitch is strong. Then the female is strong. Then the male is strong. So in the pitch domain, in the representation of pitch, different pitches are coming in and out depending on who's pronouncing, who's generating more energy at that moment, at that instant. It's in that sense that you have features that are alternating in the case of pitch, but all the other features are doing exactly the same thing and they're synchronized together for the same source. So for example, this is cartoon of the location coming from the left and from the right. When the female is alone, that is her voice is dominating the signal, she has a strong signal indicating her location. Then the male, then the female, male, female, male. So location signals are also going in and out, decorrelated from each other, and they are synchronized exactly with their corresponding, because when I produce with the pitch, for example, because when the female produces a sound, I can get from her voice the pitch and at the same time her location, her timbre, everything I need to get, all the attributes of her sound. And of course, when she opens her mouth, all of these features emerge at the same time and they die out at the same time when she closes her mouth. and the same thing for the male, and so on. So in that sense then, all of these complexes basically produce features that are synchronized or desynchronized. For one source, they're all synchronized for the... So now, this suggests a very simple algorithm for the way the brain would do this. How much time do I have? Okay, good.
So could we start at quarter to past three or so?
Yeah, no problem. Yeah. I mean, I know I have a cookie deadline, so I'll finish before that. So, just to go back to the simple case of two tones, I'm playing these alternating tones versus synchronous tones. A very simple way for the brain to solve this problem now in this case is that it looks at all these channels, A and B, for example here, and A and B are synchronized here, and so if it builds a correlation matrix, the correlation matrix would look like this, meaning A is completely correlated with itself and with B, and A and B here are correlated and B with itself is correlated. On the other hand, when they're alternating, that's what the correlation matrix looks like, right? With the blue being anti-correlated. So it's a completely different picture. A very simple way of building a correlation matrix would be exactly Hebb's rule, Hebb's law, Hebb's whatever. Basically, you have a neural tissue, let's say tonotopically organized or pitch organized or whatever it is, whatever features, this is the axis. When A and B are coming in alternating, then A and B are driven out of sync with each other. Here, they're driven in sync with each other. And if we imagine that when two neurons, A and B, are driven out of sync, negatively correlated with each other, they produce competitive interactions or negative connectivities or inhibition or competition or whatever your favorite word is, B tries to shut A down, A tries to shut B down. Whereas if they're correlated completely, then they connect themselves very rapidly with positive connectivities. Okay? They reinforce each other or enhance each other. These connectivities are rapid. Rapid in the sense, by the way, all these timings I was talking about are cortical, meaning few hertz. You don't get the stream segregation business if you go faster than 30, 40 hertz or lower than 1 hertz. When you're at 1 hertz or lower, everything sounds like a sequence. And when you're much faster, everything sounds like a mess. And you only segregate in the sweet spot of cortical dynamics. So this is the speed with which these things happen are the half a second or a second or two. Very rapid, but quick. Now, where does attention fit in? If I imagine I have these two tones playing alternating, and they formed negative connectivities quickly, within half a second or a second, then when I ask you to pay attention to the low tone here, like the violin or the bass, which is singing out of sync with the rest, if I ask you to pay attention to B, I enhance B, right? I just pump more energy in B. That's what attention does. And B is going to win the competition and shuts A down. So attention, selective attention, enhances B and shuts any competing neurons with it. And that's why it's easy for you in a competitive scene where everything is out of sync and all that, to select one and ignore the rest. It's very quick. That's not easy to do in the case of synchronous stimuli, because when I attend to B or I try to attend to B, I also enhance A. Both of them come to the foreground. Okay? But the beauty of this part is that when you listen to B, I get A for free. It binds with A. So that means if I walk into a room and I'm listening to the pitch of a female that I want to attend to, all I need to do is listen to her pitch, shine a light, attentive attention signal on the pitch neurons, which are very different from the rest of the people around her, for example. And that means that all the signals that are synchronized with her pitch signal will come into the foreground also. That's her whole voice. Her location signal, her timbre, everything about the pitch, everything about the voice of the female. Okay? So binding is the flip side of segregation, competition. Yeah?
So why, when you have both A and B at the same time, why wouldn't they inhibit each other?
They do.
Positively correlated, they don't inhibit, they enhance each other.
When they're positively correlated, they enhance each other. They both are, they don't compete, so they both are large. But if they're negatively correlated, they try to shut each other out. So they reduce each other, both of them. Unless you select one of them.
But when they're positively correlated, so yeah, they occur at the same time, not yeah, in the counterphase,
yeah,
at the same time,
yeah,
why do not they inhibit each other?
Well, as I said, because fire together, wire together.
Yeah, but this is different from the Hebb's rule. Fire together, wire together is when B stimulates A, and if they fire together,
okay, it's modified Hebb's rule. All right, fine. I'm just trying to motivate it. But the point is this. When you activate two things synchronously in the brain, they begin to form very rapid positive connectivities that enhance each other.
But you have lateral inhibition as well. You can't have.
You have lateral inhibition on this neuron with its little neighbors and all that stuff. You don't have lateral inhibition to everything. It's not like only one neuron fires in the brain. When you're listening to two tones, different, these two regions are being driven strongly.
So A and B are different regions?
They're different frequencies, for example, or different pitches, or different locations, or whatever the features A and B are.
And they're, you're saying, too far apart so that they would not inhibit each other?
They don't inhibit each other. They interfere with each other. Let's just be... more subtle.
You're saying the sign of that interaction changes dynamically based on a few seconds of correlation analysis.
Exactly.
So they may either
yes. It takes a few seconds. Well, less than a second, but it's rather quick, but it takes time. So you don't get these connectivities forming instantaneously.
What sort of time cost?
It depends on how simple the sounds are. So for tones, it's a half a second. You already have it. We measured it by...
For the speech that you showed.
I would say maybe a second or so. I don't know.
When you look at the correlation,
yeah,
I mean, it sort of moves in and out. Or if you take too short a window, mm-hmm, it's going to be something. There are going to be points.
Yeah.
Coordinated by chance.
Right. Absolutely. Yeah, but the word correlation means you have to take a window, and these windows are all done by the cortical model analysis, which is all the wavelet transforms. So there are multiple windows available simultaneously to do the correlations. I don't choose. Do it all of them, and then you pick the, you don't pick, you just add up the whole responses. In the algorithm, I'll show you the results of the algorithm. But that's literally what we do. Doesn't matter. If they are staggered, if they're still non-synchronous, it's that they're anti-correlated. It makes no difference.
Right. The question is, would they be positively correlated if they're nearly synchronous but slightly out of whack?
Oh, that's an answer to the question that Hynek said. It's about 30 milliseconds.
Right. So
is when they're, they have to be desynchronized and their onset, especially by about 30 milliseconds. As you bring them closer and closer, it becomes more and more correlated. If they're too close, the channels interfere, and they are just like those galloping rhythms, they never segregate. So that's all the criteria. And if once in a while two tones are synchronous, it doesn't matter, because the correlation is over longer time scales, typically of the order of whatever the cortical dynamics are. So half a second, quarter of a second, like that.
There's a trade-off between the ability to track differences and the ability to smooth over random changes.
It's all the same dynamics.
And so you have for the ability to segregate into speakers, like how is that relevant? Because I think you mentioned that now, right? But obviously sometimes somebody might talk in the gap of another person, but then they might talk at the same time, so it's going randomly in and out. So what would you expect?
It doesn't matter, as long as over a time scale of the order of a half a second to a second, they are not correlated exactly, so to speak. It doesn't matter if they come into sync or not.
So does this require that heavy process need to be so strong that over the course of half a second or a second, the functional sign interactions between two cells can switch from nothing to positive to negative?
Well,
like
now you're beating me and being even more extreme. The short answer is yes. This adaptive process, I'm not going to call it Hebbian, this adaptive process is very rapid and it tracks what happens to the sounds.
So I think the calling it adaptive is
I know.
Got a certain bias, and
yeah.
It might not have anything to do with synaptic weights changing, for example. It might just be activations changing, and it's
well, I mean, I'll show you the biology behind it, but you're basically modifying the responses of the neurons for exactly the same input.
What is it, through weights or?
I don't know. We don't know the mechanisms. Believe it or not, nobody has stuck two electrodes
but
in a dish and looked at. Not
adaptation.
Yeah. This is not adaptation in this sense. It's really like adaptive filters. It's not like adaptive neurons in the sense of they decay and all that stuff. This has nothing to do with SSA, with any of that stuff. This is purely meaning that the neurons change their properties on the fly depending on their activations and relation to other neurons. So the network properties change. Stick two electrodes, take a cortical slice, stick two electrodes and two neurons, and then synchronously stimulate them versus desynchronize them, look at the connectivity pattern between them. Just look at whether you have to be lucky and get two neurons that are connected, or else stimulate one and record from many others. And then when you do it synchronously versus desynchronized, there is not a single experiment in literature to do that. It's crazy, but it's really simple. I'm not ruling out anything. It could be the onset of LTD and LTP, and you're looking the evidence of that. Yeah.
That's what you do with LTP and LTP, is stick a slice in the dish and
yeah, but people usually, yeah. I don't know how quick they do this, and all the reported results tend to be over much longer time scales, as opposed to a fraction of a second. Okay, let's discuss it, because I'd like to see one reference. I asked so many people, and not a single person who works in this field of doing, you know, in vitro slice reporting has pointed one paper to do. But I would love to know which you have in mind.
LTP has nothing to do with anything. Like,
I don't know.
Too short.
It could be the onset of LTP and LTD. I don't know. As I said, I don't know. I wasn't the one who suggested it. I have a fight with her. It was Sarah. Sorry, you had a question?
Huh?
Oh, okay. All right. One experiment. So we wanted to see evidence of these connectivities forming and affecting the activity of the neurons in a ferret. So we trained a ferret to pay attention to either alternating tones or to synchronous tones. Here, we didn't ask them to selectively attend to A or B, but to attend to all of the scene, so to speak. The animal simply listened, and then when a scramble of tones came up, they could either lick or avoid the spout, depending on the training. Okay, so they react here in the red, but we have measurements either here. The purpose of doing these is that we can measure the receptive field of the neurons we're recording from right after it's been driven by B synchronous with A or B alternating with A. So it's the same exact neuron in exactly the same configuration, everything, but in some trials, one trial, it was B desynchronized from A. In another trial, alternating trial, these trials are only 2 seconds long or something, it's synchronous. The hypothesis would be that if the neuron is being driven by B, then when it's responding to synchronous with A, it would respond stronger than if it was desynchronized with A, because A and B would be inhibiting each other, and you get global inhibition between the neurons, and that's what, okay? So, when the animal is passively listening, nothing happens. There's the activation of the neurons, the average of many neurons, looks about the same whether you're preceded by alternating or by synchronous tones. But as soon as the animal is engaged in the task, you get a significant decrease in the activation of the neurons that are driven, preceded by alternating compared to synchronous. And if you look at the responses to each of these tones separately, so this is the responses. The red is the responses to the tones when they are synchronized in a synchronous environment. I'm sorry, this is here. And the blue is the responses to the tones, the same exact tones, but when they are in an alternating. And what happens is, initially there's a strong activation because of onset, and then for synchronous, they decay to a level larger than the baseline, that is, they're enhanced, whereas here, they're suppressed. And all of that happens within 400 milliseconds. Okay, so this is, you're looking at randomly presented, alternating synchronous. These neurons are changing their effective driving strength depending on whether it's preceded by alternating or synchronous, and that happens within a few hundred milliseconds.
Yeah, for the plot, your spikes per second equaling zero is actually equal to five.
That's the baseline. That's the baseline in the passive.
Spontaneous fire?
Not spontaneous, no. This is the response when they're passively listening. There's no difference between the two, and that's it. But compared to the passive, it's enhanced when they're synchronous or suppressed when they're, yeah.
Sorry,
yeah.
Are both of these tones within the receptive field of the neuron you're
recording? No, they don't have to be. We usually get four electrodes simultaneously in the cortex, and then we present tones, we select two tones, and actually the experiment is we select B tone to be as close as possible to the best frequency of two or three neurons out of the four electrodes. A is presented at different distances away from B. So we presented at quarter octave, half octave, one octave, and two octaves. And you see that the effect of A diminishes as you go to two octaves away, completely gone. Quarter octave, it makes very little difference. And the best effect is about half octave to an octave. In the ferret.
Shouldn't that depend on the frequency bandwidth of the neuron?
It does, but this is the average from many neurons with many different bandwidths and many different, yeah.
So B is set at best frequency?
As close as possible to the best frequency of because if it's far away, then it's not driving itself, there's not much to do with it, so we don't even include it. Okay, let me just, in the interest of time, tell you one last, oh my God. Here, we did the experiment with the animal paying attention to one stream versus another. And the other one was global listening, and there was no selection of one stream versus the other. With ferrets, it's not so easy to tell them pay attention to the high tone and switch to the low tone. So instead, what we did is we presented also a little noise burst. The noise burst had a little deviant in it. The animal, as far as it was concerned, everything in the world was basically to do with this noise burst. But synchronous with this noise burst, we presented the tones A and desynchronized B. And also in other trials, A was desynchronized and B was synchronized. So the hypothesis is when you pay attention to the noise and you're answering questions, so that's how we know the animal is paying attention correctly to the noise. If you look at the neurons driven by A, they should be enhanced. And for exactly the same trial, the same everything, neurons B should be suppressed. So they should decrease their responses and A should increase. And the opposite here for trials that are reversed. So that's the effect of selective attention. That is, you bind the things that... So the animal was not paying attention to...
One parent paying attention to the noise in the same animal in both of these conditions?
It's the same cell in the both of these conditions.
Same cell, yeah.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah, and we're comparing the responses of this one cell to the same exact trial and conditions, you know, randomly presented, whether synchronized or desynchronized and all that. And just in the interest of time, I'll be happy to explain later for those of you interested that basically this neurons is an example of one neuron in which when A is synchronized, the neuron is tuned to A frequency. And you see that A, when A is synchronized with the noise, it enhances its responses. And when this tone, when the cell was tuned to A and A was desynchronized, it was suppressed. So this was suppression because the cell which is tuned to A inherited. The point of this slide is to tell you that these connectivities, these effects happen remotely. The animal was not paying attention to the tones. It was paying attention to the noise, but these effects come for the ride. Whatever is synchronized with that noise, they bind, and whatever is not, they get suppressed. And let me skip this. We've done a lot of experiments now with EEG and all of that with the same idea. This is the algorithm that explains how you can do the segregation, essentially using the cortical representation and all of that. The basic idea is this. You have spectrogram coming in, it's a mixture, features are extracted, and a cortical representation is generated, so you get this cube which I explained before. Each point in the cube is fluctuating up and down depending on what it's representing. The pitch or the timbre or the location or tonotopic location or what have you. And so these channels, I'm going to call them channels, these channels are all representing the mixture, but some parts of the mixture are desynchronized from other parts. Some channels are desynchronized from other channels. That's represented here. What we do is now we simply build a correlation matrix and do effectively a PCA on it. That groups together all the channels that are coherent, correlated, and the opposite are the ones that belong to the other speaker. Literally, abstractly, that's what this algorithm is doing. This DNN is not really a DNN. It's nothing deep about it. It's two layers it's an autoencoder with two neurons doing effectively nonlinear PCA. It's a very effective way of doing that. And this is computing the correlation matrix from the different time windows or different wavelet analysis or different rates. So for 4 hertz, you compute it here. For 2 hertz, you compare the channel correlations. That's all. So this algorithm basically can do the trick and separate sounds, separate speech. Now, to go back to my first slide, you remember I showed you the pictures of images and all that, right? And I told you images is the same thing. Why? So we worked on exactly the same idea I worked with my colleague in Ecole Normale, Stéphane Malat, who's done a lot of image analysis. He said, that's precisely what people used in the algorithms for image segregation from video. And that's exactly the point. You basically only segregate images when they're moving relative to each other. Because all the pixels of one image move together. As I'm moving now, all my pixels are moving to the right. And if my head had stayed over here, you would treat me as two objects. But it doesn't. And therefore, object segregation in images is really no different than what we just did, but you have to do it in video. So why is it that we're able to look at that scene initially that I showed you of the street scene and treat these different people as different objects and the carts and all that? That's because you're basically only using memory. This has nothing to do with segregation per se. This is because you segregated people before, you acquired their images, you stored them in your memory, now you look at a static scene, you know what belongs together and what doesn't. Otherwise, you have no cues. So if you go to Mars and there's different life and different and all that stuff and different sounds and different what have you, the only way for us to make sense of that scene will be to basically look at a dynamic version of it in order to segregate it.
But we live in a 3D world. We don't only have 2D images.
Where?
We live in a three-dimensional world.
You have even more cues.
I see you're in 3D. Yeah.
That's perfect. You have even another dimension.
Exactly.
Yeah, that's even better. Sure. So this is just a summary. And so temporal coherence is the principle underlying the parsing of auditory objects. And segregating a complex sound mixture relies on the existence of unique channels. I didn't talk about this, but the point is that if you didn't have, if you have two complex sounds, two speech, and they're on top of each other, the only way you can imagine segregating that is because there are channels that are already segregated and belonging to one or the other. The problem of segregation is the problem of labeling. Which channels go together and which channels separate. And only then can you are able to solve it. I will, yeah.
Versus, you know, the enhancement of the search.
Right.
And then it seems like it's such a jump to then this, how does that help or not help calculate the coherence?
Oh, because the channels that are enhanced together, you know, because they're driven by synchronous things, they bind, they create this binding between them, these positive connectivities, and they segregate away from the ones that are competing with them, which are connected to them now by inhibitory connections. So the SDRFs change. They add basically connectivities or influences that connect them to whatever is in the brain that is synchronous with them. Now, obviously, if it's too far, it's irrelevant, but usually it's within. These are rapidly happen. They only happen under attention in the ferret. I don't know if it happens in humans or not when they're just passively listening, but I doubt it. When you're passively listening, you really are just listening to a mixture, a gibberish. It only things begin to differentiate and segregate when you attend to a scene. And finally, the same principle work exactly for visual, as I tried to explain. Yeah, I'm done.
I'm not sure you really need to go with rapid plasticity to explain a lot of these results. They're pretty similar to the stuff that Lakatos and Schroeder have reported over the past decade, where monkeys are selecting between two different rhythmic streams, and they can explain enhancement of either stream just by talking about realignment of an ongoing oscillation with a cortical excitability, et cetera. It seems like all of their framework would exactly predict a lot of the results that
so,
are shown here. Yeah.
So I honestly don't believe in anything to do with oscillations. So I'm just being honest with you. Okay. And also, all of those experiments were done at speeds where we do not stream anything. They were all done at 1 hertz and 1.2 hertz and 1.3 hertz and all that. And the choice for that is has to do with the particular oscillations that we're looking at and all that. All the so-called entrainment has to do basically with stimulus-evoked alignments. The responses are, of course, aligned with the stimuli, and so they appear to be entrained. And they give you these sort of these. So to make a long story short, take it for whatever it is. Cookies.
All right, give me a cookie.